plutonium reprocessing plants like Sellafield in the UK, the main problem was leukemia.
The radioactivity has a tremendous power that can penetrate the human gene, affecting generation after generation. Jamal is a Palestinian policeman. He was arrested after the second intifada and spent 13 years in jail. Now he is free, but living a new hell. His daughter has cancer. At the age of 9, she was diagnosed with leukemia. Nothing in the medical report says this Palestinian girl is a direct victim of Dimona. But she comes from an area that counts 70% of cancer cases among the Palestinian population. Israel is probably the sixth or even fifth nuclear power in the world. While others should open the doors of their nuclear programs for inspections, Israel is a special case, producing nuclear weapons since the 60s without any control. Meanwhile, the cancer cases and other diseases are spreading across Israel, Palestine and neighboring Arab countries. The victims die without knowing what or who is killing them.
Well, even if Dimona's deadly weapons of mass destruction are never used, still, the reactor has been silently killing masses of defenseless citizens throughout the decades, and it continues doing so. And by continuing to maintain and operate the Dimona reactor, Israel is committing a crime against humanity that will be added to the atrocities that it's perpetrated throughout its history. And that's it for this week, everyone. Join us next time for another Aperture. It's goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Trump administration knew it would not be able to reunite refugee and other migrant families as it ripped children, including infants, from the arms of their parents, but did so anyway, according to a congressional report released on the U.S. government's family separation policy. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading Reckless Incompetence and Intentional Cruelty. House issues a scathing report on Trump migrant family separation policy. Here's the details. The Trump administration knew it would not be able to reunite refugee and other migrant families as it ripped children, including infants, from the arms of their parents, but did so anyway, according to a congressional report released recently on the U.S. government's family separation policy. The House Judiciary Committee spent 21 months investigating the planning and execution of the administration's policy, which resulted in the seizure of more than 2,500 migrant children, including some with physical and mental disabilities, from their parents. Its report is the first complete narrative of the inhumane family separation policy in the administration's own words. The report reveals that the separation policy lasted far longer than is commonly known and was marked by reckless incompetence and intentional cruelty. Worse still, administration officials knew that the government lacked the capacity to track separated family members and moved forward with separations anyway, the report states. The investigators conclude that the family separation policy was driven by an administration that was willfully blind to its cruelty and determined to go to unthinkable extremes to deliver on political promises. To this day, the U.S. government is unable to find the parents, roughly two-thirds of whom are believed to have been deported, of 545 children. An unknown number of these children, some of whom were babies when they were taken, may never see their mothers or fathers again. Many of these victims are what prominent cities, including Physicians for Human Rights, have called torture and state-sanctioned child abuse, had done nothing wrong, having presented themselves at U.S. ports of entry and requested asylum in full accordance with the law after fleeing violence or persecution in their home countries, and much of it resulting from U.S. policies and actions. The committee's report makes clear that the Trump administration was willing to go to extreme length, including ripping young children and children with disabilities from the arms of their parents, to stop migrants fleeing violence from seeking protection in the United States, said House Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler and Immigration Subcommittee Chair Zhu Lofgren in a joint statement. Now, more than a year since the end of this cruel policy, the Trump administration has failed to reunite hundreds of children with their families, they said. The incompetence is unforgivable. As we move forward, we need a whole-of-government approach to reunite these families and put an end to this dark chapter in the nation's history. The report found that the administration began devising its plan to separate families within weeks of President Donald Trump's inauguration, and that it accelerated separations even before fully developing its policy. By March 2017, separations had increased 900% from November 2016. In July 2017, without warning, the administration launched a pilot program in El Paso that lasted 5 months, and in which hundreds of children were seized from their parents. It was during this program that the government determined it would not be able to track or reunite many families. Nevertheless, the administration expanded the policy nationwide in May 2018. Making matters worse, the U.S. administration failed to notify frontline agents and officers of the new program, causing unnecessary chaos and inconsistent implementation of the policy across border sectors. Human rights groups once again condemned the administration's policy and actions in the wake of the new report. Today's report only confirms what this administration's immigration policies have shown. Cruelty was always the point, Amnesty International refugee and migrant rights researcher Dennis Bell said in a statement. This administration's deliberate policy to separate families inflicted severe mental suffering, all in order to deter people from seeking safety or to coerce them into giving up, said Bell. This is called torture, and there must be accountability for these heinous acts. there must be an effective criminal investigation of all government officials, personnel, and contractors who are responsible for this shameful period of history, no matter the current or former level of office, Bell added. Immigration advocates have called family separation along with forced surgical removal of reproductive organs of migrant women the worst domestic human rights violations of Trump administration. As public outrage mounted in the face of stories like a breastfeeding baby being torn away from her mother and a father driven to suicide after being separated from his wife and child, the administration reluctantly rolled back the policy in late June 2018. But the damage was done. Both parents and children, who were often told by U.S. officials that they would never see each other again, have suffered tremendous emotional and psychological trauma. Some, as shown by hundreds of children still separated from their parents, may indeed never be reunited. Some of the children have been given to U.S. families who are sometimes able to petition for permanent custody of them. Representative Raul Gurridge-Lava said recently that those 545 children are effectively orphaned with the explicit consent and active participation of the Trump administration. They were ripped from their parents' arms, offhandedly placed in shelters, and left no wonder when, if ever, they would see their parents again, he said. Due to the cruelty of Donald Trump and the xenophobia of White House advisor Stephen Miller, we know that some of them may never see their parents again. At least seven children have also died while imprisoned by U.S. authorities. This is while Trump still continues to defend the separation policy, falsely claiming that the seized children were brought into the country by human traffickers.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. More unrest in the United States as yet another black man has been killed by police in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. 14 shots were fired by police at 27-year-old Walter Wallace, who had a knife. Now, those protesting are angry at police for not handling the situation in a different way and say if he had been a white man, he would have never been fatally wounded. Well, stay with us as we take a look at what has been sweeping the United States, especially this year. On this debate, we're going to start off in Washington, D.C., joined by Colin Cabell. Well, fill us in on this latest situation, this time out of Philadelphia, and also curfews are in effect.
That's right. This involves the case of Walter Wallace, a young man who has a history of mental health issues, and his parents say that when they called the police, or 911 rather, for an emergency responder, they were hoping that a health official would show up. They were calling because he had an episode, a mental health episode, which was not unfamiliar to him, but when it did happen from time to time, it could become violent. And they were hoping that the hospital, a representative from the hospital, first responder, someone who could de-escalate the situation would show up. Well, the police showed up, and that often happens when you call 911 in the U.S. Well, instead of really trying to control the situation where they could have a peaceful outcome, they told him to lower a knife that he had been holding. After they told him several times to lose the knife, they opened fire on him, killing him, and that was the end of Walter Wallace there, who died in a hail of police gunfire. He was shot in the chest and in the shoulder, and he was brought to the hospital where he later died. Now, people are saying that that did not have to happen, and that's why you hear protesters talking about defunding the police. It doesn't mean they want to get rid of police. What defund the police means is taking funds, money, that is usually just given to police departments, but also giving it to other departments so that on specific calls, these other departments can answer those calls so they don't end up in fatal shootings like what happened with Mr. Wallace.
All right. Thank you so much, Colin, for that. We're going to cross over now to St. Petersburg, Florida, where we're joined by African People's Socialist Party member Omali Yeshetela. Thank you so much for being with us. Omali, you heard our correspondent in Washington talking about the overall situation. And I mean, we have heard this so many times, time and time again. And many people are asking, why 14 shots? Why would, first of all, police have to open fire 7 rounds each police officer for somebody who was carrying a knife but seemed, from the video I saw, not lunging at them?
Yes, thank you very much. And I think we have been hearing this over and over and over again. And it seems to me we've been hearing it enough to recognize that this cannot be an accident. This is not just some careless policing or the absence of body cameras or some kind of insensitivity on the part of the police department. Every police department in this country suffers from this problem. And it is because what the police here are dealing with is our community, African people, in the same way that an occupying army, a military force in a foreign territory would treat people. It's you hear these kinds of accidents, like killing this brother, shooting him so many times. You hear this kind of thing happening with the U.S. in Afghanistan, with the U.S. in other foreign territories where they are occupying. They know they're a hostile occupying a military force, and that's what they represent in the African community, with Africans in particular, but also with indigenous people in this country, because you have to remember that the United States is a settler colony. It's a settler colony where Europeans came here just like they went to Israel, just like they went to Australia and other places like that, and took the land and enslaved the people. In this instance, of course, they brought Africans to this country where they enslaved us. And we've been living under settler colonial domination. It's a colonizer country. And what we saw happen with this brother Wallace is a consequence of any time you have settler colonialism, the proclivity to kill, kill, kill.
Well, let me welcome my next guest to the program out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, Jack Rice, lawyer and media activist. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Jack, what I was saying to Omali, I mean, we've repeated this so many times and hearing about this. And in this year, 2020, we've witnessed many people protesting and highlighting police violence, especially against African Americans. Yet we continue to witness more African Americans being killed by police still on a regular base. So what's key here? What is missing? What has to be done? Because, as I said, we've seen many demonstrations, and the police are under a lot more scrutiny, but still we're seeing the same result.
Well, I've been listening to your previous guests, and I think first what I would say is we may be witnessing more attacks on African Americans, but the reason we're witnessing is because people have cell phones. If you look back historically, you can take a look at what's going on in the United States, where African Americans, indigenous people, Native Americans, and others have been targeted again and again and again. The numbers are astounding right now, only because you can't deny them. What we have seen in the past is the United States and frequently police departments have simply denied these issues, and then they go away. But what we know now is that while there are numbers and they continue to be as astounding as they are, we're still seeing a very small number of police officers who are actually being prosecuted. Even further, the number of police officers who are actually being convicted is even less. And I'm coming to you as a former prosecutor, a criminal defense lawyer. I walk into courtrooms almost every single day. And so I watch how these issues play themselves out. A lot of my clients are people of color. And as a result of that, I see those issues, and I've seen it in courtrooms. I've seen it from juries. I've seen it from judges. I've seen it from prosecutors. And I've absolutely seen it from police officers.
Go ahead, Amali.
I think that's a really important statement that he just made, that it has been happening all along. And it's not that people didn't know about it. I'm old enough to remember the U.S. engagement in Vietnam and how one of the problems the United States had was that media were there on the ground, and they were recording the crimes that the United States was committing against the people of Vietnam. And the truth is that the colonizer wants to maintain the status quo, wants to maintain the colonized, but doesn't want to see it, doesn't want to see the consequences of what he's voting for, of what he's supporting, et cetera. And that's what's happening here in this country, in the United States. As the gentleman mentioned, this has been happening a long time, but now you've got cell phones, and you can look at it, and you can see a cop with his knee on the neck killing an African man after holding him, pressing him for more than 8 minutes. And normally, traditionally, what happens when we say that the police have done this, the police have done that, and our community's response from the white community is, well, you must have done something. They wouldn't just do that to you. You must have done something. And that's been the tradition up until recently, and now it's something that cannot be easily dismissed, and I don't think it'll ever go away, despite all of the kinds of things that different social media organizations are trying to do to keep people from seeing what's going on, or to frame what people are seeing as some kind of intervention from some foreign country.
Well, Amali, you said that you feel that it's not going to go away because it's being seen. But being seen, is it enough? Will there be changes that will be implemented? I mean, if we look at, we're in almost the end of 2020, and we have been seeing this, especially highlighted this year. Do you think that major changes have taken place? I mean, if we go back to 50 years ago, we've been seeing African Americans and demonstrating against racism and against police violence. So being out there more, do you think that in itself is enough to bring about a change?
No, I don't. I think that if they were able to change, they'd do it. I heard leading into this story how, despite the fact that there have been so many killings, so many protests, and things like that, things still remain the same. Why? I mean, and the fact of the matter is that the protests are so serious now, they're having to talk about sending in national or federal troops and federal forces to try to keep it down. If they could not do it, they would not do it. If it were possible, the reason it's not possible is because African people live under colonial domination, and it's only this nonsense about racism, white people don't like us, or what they call systematic racism. If you get rid of that and treat what's happening to African people like how we treat it happening to anybody else in the world, it's colonialism. And people will not suffer the kinds of things that's happened to them by foreign and alien power without the use of extreme violence. And there's no way they can control this community, control African people, control Mexicans, control the indigenous people whose land they've stolen without extreme violence. And the police is that arm of the state that's most closely associated with the people on the ground, in the street. It's the first line of an oppressive system in defense of the oppressive system itself.
Well, Jack, your take on that, because we've seen this growing schism in the United States. When we talk about, especially on the one hand, when we talk about demonstrations, we've seen many white Americans, young white Americans, actually even taking the lead in some of the demonstrations. On the other hand, we see this polarization of other sections of the society. Based on what Amali just said, how likely is it that this society is heading towards more violence? As he said, more and more African Americans are seeing that so many years of protests and really nothing has changed, that at the end of the day, do you think that they will feel that only violence can meet violence?
I think that it'll wax and wane, to be honest. I think that this is a slow and ongoing process. I certainly understand the frustration. I certainly do. And again, I'm in South Minneapolis. I live 9 blocks from where George Floyd was murdered in the street. So I think about what that means. And yet at the same time, I think that there are people who are starting to understand and starting to address issues. Is it enough? Absolutely not. Is it systemic in terms of how things are applied? It absolutely is. And the idea that somehow some will assume and are arguing that it's a question of history, how African Americans were treated under slavery, misses the point fundamentally, because it happens today. It happens right now. I'm not just talking about redlining and the history of redlining. I'm talking about the impact that is happening to people of color in the United States today. And this has happened this afternoon, this morning, and the reaction from those who wish to deny it. And it's that gulf, the gulf between those who don't even see it on the one side, purposely, willingly, and those who have to live with it every single day. It's the need to bridge that gulf, which takes so much time and so much effort. But I'm an optimist. I have to believe that slowly but surely, we can do more. We can be a better people. Martin Luther King was right. We can do more.
I want to just appreciate what this comrade has said. I think it's really important what he said, and he draws out the point that I want to make, that it is systemic, and this system is colonialism, and I think it's important to say it's systemic because, as you raised earlier, that you see white people who are out in demonstrations and holding up their fists and what have you, and it does show the ability on some minimal level of Africans and white people to get along together on some to some extent. That I am not disagreeing with, although I might be able to say that the material interest that and involved here doesn't mean that it's exactly what it looks like. But I do want to say that people do have that kind of ability under certain circumstances. The problem is that it's not a question of whether people like each other. It's an institutional relationship. It's called colonialism. And in colonialism, there's an oppressor nation and oppressed nation of people. And that relationship is something that is consolidated and codified. And the state itself functions as the protector of that relationship between the colonized and the colonizer. That's what the police is. The police are an arm of the state. It's an occupying military force that imposes itself on African people who are colonized in order to maintain that relationship. So I agree with him 100% that people do have a greater ability, it seems right now, to get along together. But people have to understand that what we're suffering from is not, quote unquote, just people not liking each other. It's a question of power and whether or not African people ourselves should have control over our lives so that we don't have to hope and pray that some juncture, enough young white people or old white people or what have you, will think highly enough of us or on their own humanity that they'll stop killing us. We have to have the power, and to do that, we have to destroy this relationship of colonialism. And that's the domination of one people by a foreign and alien power, and that's what we have here, just as we have had in Afghanistan and other places around the world.
Well, staying with what you've just said, Omalie, and basically that you're dealing with a colonialist power, so given that paradigm, and if we look at other colonialist entities, they usually did not allow individuals to vote into a change or to pressure them into a change. They usually had to be under so much pressure that basically they were brought down. So what does that mean when you're looking at the United States and African Americans' relationship with the United States? What needs to be done in order to bring about that reality that you were talking about?
Well, first of all, I want to say that on November 7th and 8th, the Black Hispanic Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparation that I chair is holding in Washington, D.C., a rally on Saturday, November the 7th, under the theme, Down with Colonialism, Black Power Matters, and Black Community Control of the Police. All of these are anti-colonial demands that presupposes the democratic right of African people to have control of our own lives, independent of the United States government that historically has done what it does and to us, etc. So we have to be able to fight for our own power. And we've had those kinds of movements in the past that were violently crushed by the United States government. There are scores of political prisoners in this country right now. And some have been in prison for 50 years just for trying to win freedom of black people. So what has to happen is that we have to become independent of both the Democrat and Republican Party or any sector of the ruling class and forge our own way. That's the thing that we are involved in doing. That's what I do on a regular basis. So it's going to be up to African people ourselves to take power over our own lives. It's not going to be given to us. It's not going to be something that all of a sudden there's going to be some kind of epiphany. And they say, wow, we've done that, black people badly. African people ourselves are going to have to do that, and that's what we're busily engaged in doing. People should come to that Black is Back mobilization on Saturday, the November 7th. Again, under the slogan, that black power matters, down with colonialism. Down with colonialism and black community control of the police. And that's going to be in Washington, D.C. Okay. And we're going to have that rally and march on the White House. And then right across the street from the White House, we're going to have another rally and a conference on the following day.
Okay. All right. Well, Jack, your take, you just heard Omalie basically saying it's not going to make a difference. We're dealing with Democrats or we're dealing with Republicans. And we're just a few days out from the election. And there's been a lot of debate and controversy, and especially dealing with the black vote. Does it make a difference if a Democrat is in the White House or if a Republican is in the White House as far as that reality for black Americans, especially when we're talking about police violence?
I think it can in this sense, and it's complicated. If you think about the makeup of the Supreme Court right now, we have now seen a 6-3 split, essentially conservative. And you have to understand, over the last 25 or 30 years, you've seen the Supreme Court continue to swing right anyway. So to call 6 of them conservatives and only 3 liberals, if you look at the numbers, it frankly doesn't reflect that. It's probably even further to the right than that. And yet, a poor analogy, but an analogy nevertheless, is what we saw with gay marriage. One of the issues that happened with gay marriage was it only was accepted by the Supreme Court and acceptable by the Supreme Court once a vast majority of people within the country itself said, we must have this. And so to say that they don't reflect society, I think it ignores the reality that political pressure can have on the system itself.
Okay.
I think frequently it's the shift, it's the change in society that drives the political powers to move. It's not the other way around.
Amina, your take about this, there are some that are talking about possible violence even after the election. We have seen more and more militia groups and even black militia groups taking to the streets, heavily armed. What do you think? How likely is that to happen, that this polarization continues and actually clashes? Actually violent clashes taking place?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that there are black people, Africans, who are gay too. And so to say there's gay rights and somehow is some kind of astounding development. But what about the Africans who are prosecuted, persecuted, whatever their sexual preferences or orientation happens to be? Being black is not something that's eradicated because they say they're gay rights. And gay rights is something that they can give and supposed to be for everybody, but it's obviously not for everybody. It applies to white people because black people don't have any rights, whether they're heterosexual, homosexual, asexual, or anything else like that. That's one thing. And in terms of, I think there's a great possibility of violence in this country. The president himself is suggesting the need for that if he's not elected. And we're seeing from all of these security organizations of the U.S. government predicting the likelihood of violence. The FBI has established a command post in virtually every state in this country, certainly where there are Africans and white people living in the same place. So they're talking about violence and the possibility of violence. And so that's a great possibility. And I think the issue for us is that there's violence that our people are afflicted by all the time. And if you mentioned black militia groups, I haven't seen black militia groups that have come out, like Kyle Rittenhouse, who right close to where the attorney here is from, Kyle Rittenhouse, who comes out as a 16, 17-year-old white kid, shoots three people, kills two of them, and already have had several $100,000 in donations given to his defense by other white people around the country.
30 seconds, O'Malley, 30 seconds, go ahead.
It's an extraordinarily polarized situation. America's in a state of existential crisis, and the people of must be free. African people have to be free, regardless of what party is in power or if either party is in power. I want to thank you, Uhuru.
And I thank both of you for being with us. From the African People's Socialist Party, O'Malley Yeshatila out of St. Petersburg, Florida. Lawyer and media activist Jack Rice out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense. The very sensitive and outstanding leadership and command of Imam Khomeini.
The second point is that the Sacred Defense was one of the most rational events for the Iranian nation. Some people accuse the people active in the Sacred Defense of lacking insight, citing some mistake made here and there by a group of people. This is not the case in any way. The actions done during the Sacred Defense were intelligent and rational from start to finish. In the beginning, the speeches made by Imam or others indicated the right decision to enter into that arena. After that, we witnessed cooperation between the Guards Corps and the Army. Notice that this is a very important matter. In those days, the army was a traditional and well-established organization in the country, And the Guards Corps was a young newcomer in the revolutionary arena. It was necessary for them to work together, something that was not easy, but it happened.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, when Bani Sadr fled the country, this happened in a better and more complete manner. But it existed before that too. I myself witnessed in Abu Dhar base that the late Shahid Pichak was the second in command to the army commander of that base, whose name I do not remember. A Guards Corps commander was the second in command to an army commander. They would work and live together. In the western part of the country, the Abu Dhar base was a sensitive place as they were in charge of a large section of the war. When the new development took place, Bani Sadr fleeing the country and the Imam undertaking the responsibility to command the armed forces, the cooperation between the army and the Guards Corps became even clearer.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Limelight. According to a recent report, the number one obstacle to U.S. voter participation, regardless of one's income level, are the beliefs that candidates are not speaking to their issues and that their vote will not matter. A candidate openly attesting that they may not honor election results is a signal to the public that their vote will not count. This obstacle becomes even greater to poor and low-income Americans who are 20% less likely to vote in national elections than those with higher incomes. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Shana East Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "Is Trump Trying to Suppress Votes by Saying He Will Disregard Election Results?" Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. U.S. President Donald Trump has been casting doubt on the results with veiled warnings like, "The only way we're going to lose this election is if the election is rigged." He panders to law enforcement at his rallies and has earned the endorsement of the largest police union in the U.S., causing worries that the president may be angling for their extra legal support on Election Day. During the first presidential debate, Trump spoke directly to the far-right group, the Proud Boys, telling them to stand back and stand by. And he encouraged his supporters to show up at the polls to keep watch, leading to anxieties about public intimidation or even violence at polling places. Add to this the right-wing demonization of the Black Lives Matter movement and anti-fascists, a global pandemic and looming economic crisis, and we have a powder keg of conditions that an authoritarian leader like Trump could exploit to remain in power should not he win the ballot box. The passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, leaving a vacancy on U.S. Supreme Court, has only raised further questions about the integrity of 2020 election. With Trump-appointed Justice Amy Coney Barrett newly sworn in, we will see a court split with 6 conservative-leaning and only 3 liberal-leaning justices. U.S. Constitution is ambiguous enough for bad actors to exploit in close races, as we saw in 2000 presidential election, and the Electoral College only complicates matter. Trump could even persuade GOP-controlled state legislatures to submit separate slates of electors, declaring him the winner, despite the certified popular vote. Democrats are trying to combat some of these threats in advance of the election. On October 16th, Senate Democrats offered a purview of their plan to counter tactics that may be deployed by Trump and the GOP with the release of a guide called Counting Votes and What to Expect on Election Day, which primarily serves to rely basic voting rights with details about the final dates for vote counting in key battleground states. The guide also asks Americans to be patient and reject misinformation in the case that we do not have complete counts on November 3rd. Democrats are also pushing for a huge turnout to limit doubts about the winner and will be working overtime to ensure that all votes are tallied. Legal strategy is being directed primarily by the Biden campaign, with support from Democratic National Committee Counsel Mark Elias, whose focus has been on mail-in voting laws. Another strategy two Democrats on Armed Services Committee have employed is to make formal on the record requests of Trump cabinet members calling for their commitment to a peaceful transition of power if he were to lose the election. The Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, a U.S. nonprofit think tank and arguably the bipartisan political committee for the global ruling class, has published numerous articles slamming the president on everything from economics to foreign policy. Richard Haass, president of CFR, has called Trump's presidency and style of governing a threat to liberal world order, a liability for a great power and never strategically good, and says what we need is predictability, reliability, and continuity. Trump's presidency, particularly during the COVID-19 crisis, has been incredibly destabilizing for the economy and what the Council longingly refers to as international world order. Like his other lies, gaslighting, and media stunts, Trump's repeated stoking of election fears has had a profound effect on the public's consciousness. A recent poll shows that 47% of Americans are afraid that Trump may lose the election but refuse to concede, and that number jumps up to 75% among Biden voters. Is the threat of Trump not accepting the election results a form of voter suppression? According to a recent report, the number one obstacle to voter participation, regardless of one's income level, are the beliefs that candidates are not speaking to their issues and that their vote will not matter. A candidate openly attesting that they may not honor election results is a signal to the public that their vote will not count. This obstacle becomes even greater to poor and low-income Americans who are 20% less likely to vote in national elections than those with higher incomes. Trump's onslaught of lies distorts common sense knowledge over time, normalizing extremist ideas or actions. When the public accepts or adheres to such manipulations, this is what master propagandist and public relations pioneer Edward Bernays termed the engineering of consent. This propaganda can generate fear in the public. Trump may be counting on a U.S. too overwhelmed to participate or fight back. Trump has been misdirecting the public with his negative rhetoric about mail-in voting, giving the impression that it may fraudulently benefit his opponent. But even before the pandemic, mail-in voting was gaining popularity among Democrats and Republicans alike. In 2018, one in four votes was cast by mail, and the prevalence of voting by mail has been increasing across a wide range of personal characteristics, and there is little difference in voting by mail according to income status. In past elections, researchers at Stanford University found that there is little to no evidence that mail-in voting benefits one party or the other, and Trump's tactic may well backfire for him. Trump's war on the U.S. Postal Service and voting by mail suppresses votes across the political spectrum, including members of his own older and higher COVID risk base. Some of the blue shift we are starting to see could be thanks to Trump's politicization of the pandemic, with calls for his supporters to be at the polls on Election Day, both for intimidation purposes and to collect evidence of so-called fraud. Given the current conditions and political climate, no one can accurately predict what may go down on Election Day. But those committed to ensuring that every ballot is counted will need to be flexible and ready to take down. Coups can be stopped when citizens reject misinformation, do not consent to illegal actions, and when the people demonstrate their power. But this is just the first step. Regardless of the outcome of this election, the U.S. faces intersecting crises of unemployment, housing and food insecurity, racial injustice, lack of adequate health care coverage, overwhelming debt and climate catastrophe. It's not enough to mobilize voters and protect the polls for one election. We must remember that voter suppression takes place when states are deliberately not organized to participate in elections. This means that those in power intend to benefit from a populace that is misinformed, has lost faith in their representatives, and feels as though their votes won't matter.